at that instant of time from a global positioning satellite. And as such, when they say, I'm going to be on this particular frequency at this time, on this particular mountain, I'm going to be transmitting toward you, and now you know exactly where to tune your receiver at 10.368.0375 megahertz in order to hear me. And they get accuracy to the nearest 1 hertz, whereas you just take an ordinary 10 gig transverter. Let me drop it. And 10 years ago, I bought a very nice transverter for 10 gigs that was made by a company in Germany, and I'm sure SSB Electronics. And on a hot day versus a cold day, with all the electronics in a box behind my dish on the top of 100 feet of tower, that frequency would move easily 10 kc high and low. And I had to make a calibration curve as to what my real frequency was versus the temperature of the air on that particular day. I'd look up my curve, and I could get to the nearest 100 hertz or so. But out of the 10 kc or so of drift that I was getting versus temperature, these guys are getting to the nearest 1 hertz. And so they just tune the receiver accurately and sit there and wait for Mother Nature to give them an atmospheric burst of some kind, an atmospheric inhomogeneity where the signal starts coming through. They don't have to be scanning the dish in azimuth and elevation, scanning the receiver up and down in frequency, and making sure that they're doing all this at the right time and the guy is transmitting. As you can see, it's a 3- or 4-dimensional search in order to find a weak signal from one mountaintop to the other. And these guys, by way of some of these techniques, are making it a lot better. Bill, what's the latest frequency accuracy of cell sites? WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, I apologize for my crappy signal, and I'll be brief. So a lot of Lucent or Alcatel-Lucent base stations have two reference oscillators in them. One of them, out of the box, is supposed to be a rubidium. The backup to it is supposed to be a TCXO. However, in practical application, the rubidiums were expensive. So once you had a failure, a lot of times the base stations would end up with two TCXOs instead of a rubidium and a TCXO. So you never necessarily know what accuracy you're getting, at least from a Lucent base station, because it depends on what complement of hardware has been split into the card slots to make repairs. That's it, WB2QGZ.
A little bit noisy, but you came through very well, Bill. And the expression that Bill used a number of times, TCXO, temperature compensated crystal oscillator, TCXO is what that stands for. And a crystal oscillator where the manufacturer in theory has measured its frequency output for various temperatures and put the exact inverse curve into a microprocessor that's married to that particular oscillator. By way of a temperature compensating techniques, you can buy these days a 10 megahertz oscillator that probably is going to have an accuracy of a small fraction of 1 hertz of accuracy over most conditions. And I've owned a few of those. They're extremely good. In fact, the oscillator, the main reference oscillator that's built into many of these modern-day frequency counters by Hewlett-Packard, Agilent, and other companies, and Ritsu, really is a great big assembly, which is about 2 inches wide, 2 inches high, and about 6 inches deep. And inside of that chamber, inside of that box, is all kinds of ovens and other things to make a very precise 10 megahertz oscillator for the reference, for the main timing that allows it to measure frequencies. So, and there's various ways that you can then check on the accuracy of that reference oscillator. So, what percentage of the time, Bill, do you think these cell sites, and what percentage of the cell sites, give me a very rough guess, is it 10% or 90% of the cell sites that periodically are not being referenced to a global positioning satellite receiver? WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, I realize what I said might be a little misleading. All of the cell sites I have experience with are typically referenced to GPS, and the GPS disciplines the reference oscillator. And the idea was that you would...
Yeah, plus it's still cold down in the basin.
The rubidium reference oscillator would give you an extremely long period of time of reliability with no GPS, where the cell site would say, I have confidence in my frequency stability or frequency standard, and I'm going to stay on the air. If it was running on the TCXO, you could only, in other words, the base station would say, I'm going to shut down in a couple hours because I no longer have confidence in my oscillator.
time, Bill, and I've got an auxiliary question on this one. It is my guess that these extreme frequency accuracies are required at modern-day cell sites because of the very complicated procedure the individual cell sites have got to go through in order to do a handoff. Assuming that I'm driving at the 60 miles an hour on the Long Island Expressway and I'm talking on a cell phone, and as I drive from Riverhead toward New York City, I'm probably going to go through, let me pick a number, 15 individual cell sites. As I start running out of the range of one and going into the range of the other, the whole darn system has to figure out where I am, which cell site I'm getting closer to, which cell site I'm getting further away from, which cell sites are getting a better signal for me than the others, and they do a handoff. And so all of a sudden, I'm talking from cell site number 13 to cell site number 41, and there has to be a handoff which in theory doesn't skip a beat and doesn't lose a cycle of my voice, even though it's now coming from an entirely different location that might be 10 miles away. That very complicated handoff procedure with the very complicated timing of that spread spectrum signal. My voice is being broken down. Let me drop. I'm guessing that my voice is being broken down digitally into a very complicated code, and all the chips and bits of that code have to be accurately received from one cell site, and all of a sudden they're going to another cell site that for every foot of distance, there's a nanosecond of difference in time. For every mile, there is a 5,000 nanoseconds of difference. So in order for that timing to work out correctly, when I get handed off from one cell site to the other, the computers on that system have to know exactly where I am, what the new signal is going to be like, and what the timing is like. Therefore, all kinds of frequency accuracy is required for them not to to lose the digital code and have a dropout. Bunch of guesses on my part. How close have I come, Bill? WB2QGZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
You're right there. So in the case of TDMA technologies like Motorola's now defunct IDEN on the network, the Nextel network, that's all here now, that was a TDMA, and GSM, your timing needs to be good enough so that you're hitting the correct time slot when you hand over. And that's important, otherwise you become an island and you drop calls. In the case of CDMA cells, everybody's on the same frequency now, so your offset is time and of course phase dependent to determine what cell you're on and what your neighbors are and everything else. So in both cases, that accurate timing is required, and lack of GPS would eventually cripple those networks. Now in LTE, some of the later technologies, you're able to use in some cases transport-based timing, or in other words, backhaul-based timing. But I don't have a whole lot of experience with that. But that's sort of another later possibility. Okay.
What we are all hearing is the fact that some genius a long time ago realized that this simple sounding thing called radio and wireless equipment, once married with a really smart set of computers, and where you start breaking down the voice into a digital code, and now you start transmitting that digital code with code division, multiple access, frequency division, multiple access, spread spectrum techniques, and there's a zillion of those, and now you try to break that audio down, compress it, send it through with the least number of bits, with leading edge, what am I looking at, enough preamble to the packets so that there is a forward error correcting code capability called Viterbi, among others. Wow. You ain't heard the end of this one yet. You combine computers with smart people with spread spectrum techniques on wireless pieces of hardware, and the hams have gotten a little bit of piece of this action by way of the Joe Taylor technique, K1JT, Joe Taylor techniques for sending very weak signals to the moon, or reflected off satellites, or reflected off meteor scatter. Let me drop. The Joe Taylor techniques for sending Morse code-like signals allows you to take what your normal hearing would listen to, a weak Morse code signal in the noise, and by way of the Joe Taylor more digital techniques of transmitting the code, the individual symbols, as a mixture of four individual tones that have particular protocol and timing. It's a little bit like a radio teletype, but it's a lot more complicated. The Joe Taylor techniques can dig, in some cases, 28 dB into the noise. The signal can be 28 dB below the noise level of your receiver, and that Morse code interpreting program of Joe Taylor will print out that message across the screen. There's a couple of catches, though, and that is the absolute edge of the art in moon bounce on this technique. Some of the guys are using a priori knowledge. In other words, the computer program that's trying to put that message all back together, that's an extremely weak and extremely dispersed and spread signal reflecting off of that moon, where the right-hand side of the moon is moving at a different velocity compared to the left side of the moon as far as your base station is concerned. And so you're getting a funny kind of flutter from all of that signal. And so by way of the a priori knowledge given to the state-of-the-art program, where it knows what is the list of call letters or currently active people doing moon bounce. Not looking at the whole list that's on the QIZ.com. It's only looking at a very specific list of call letters that are people who have gone through the heroic effort of setting up a 400-square-foot antenna in their backyard to do moon bounce with 1.5 kilowatts of transmit power and 0.2 dB of noise figure. For a guy who's done all of that, he is well known. So you got this list of call letters of possible people that are now...
Repeater, time out.
You got this list of possible people that are now transmitting call letters. And so, in my case, it may recognize K-tube-R blank I blank. And it says, hey, that's possibly K-2-R-I-W. It puts in the R and the W, but it didn't really receive them. But it looks at all the possibles, and it says, that's the most likely guy. Well, there are guys who are becoming a little bit unhappy about that. My good friend Ken, W5EJB, who hasn't done any moon bounce in the last 3 years, has on two occasions gotten a QSL card from a guy who thought he talked to Kent off the moon by one of these computer programs. And it never really took place. So occasionally some false alarms or misdetections do take place. See, you can stretch it, but just so far, there's a... you're getting a certain... In everything in life, there is an error ratio. No matter how sincere you are as an antenna engineer or as an electronic engineer or as a radio maven or whatever, all of your pronouncements are only going to have an accuracy a certain percentage of the time. None of us bats 1,000. And very slowly, we got to admit that to ourselves. We're vulnerable to making mistakes. And sometimes you got to be humble enough to admit you've made a mistake. Maybe you've got to admit it internally in order to work harder to try to correct it. KC2WGB, I'm going off into velocity here today, John. K2RW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. Yeah, mistakes. I thought I made one once. There was a mistake. All right. Very good. I'm sure you're going to have a lot of fun with that little Beckman. It's a good device, and you only paid $15 on eBay for it. And it seems to work well. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go into an antenna question here. Okay, Dick, I hope you read some of QST, because this question is on page 41 of an article, and it's called Nested Antennas. All right. He only needs 4 frequencies. This covers 5. But he wants to know your thoughts about that design, because he can use it for his... trips that he makes, and he has designed a very good system for making it fold up. It's amazing how small it is when it's folded up. So if you've read that article or if you saw that antenna, he'd like to know what you think about it, and do you think it's worth building? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I have in my hand the March issue of 2014 QST Magazine. Tell me once again what page number I should go to, John.
41.
Okay, I recognize the antenna, and I think it's a cubicle quad-like antenna, which has a bunch of nested individual loops with the individual bands, I presume. Now, I didn't read this article, but let me make a couple of guesses first. Are those, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, four, five. He's got five nested red loops fed with five pieces of cable. And would I be correct in assuming that they're working on five separate frequencies? And he doesn't want to build all five. Is that roughly what's going on?
That's correct.
If he leaves out some of those loops, will the others be interfered with? And the answer is almost no. In other words, this is the cubical quad equivalent of a fan dipole. In the case of a fan dipole, your favorite bands might be 80, 40, 20, 15, 10. Those five bands, you set up five dipoles that are each a half wavelength long at that frequency. You bring them all together at one common center where you've got a good balance, a broadband balance in your coaxial cable. And then the tips of those individual dipoles are all separated by insulators and individual ropes and various techniques, catenaries and so on. And so the 80-meter dipole doesn't give a darn about the fact that there's a 40, 20, 15, and 10 there. It doesn't see it. The 40-meter dipole will have a little bit of capacitive end loading effect when it sees the size of the 80-meter dipole. Therefore, the 40-meter dipole will have to be made a tiny bit shorter in order to hit the frequency right on. If you didn't do it, it would still be good enough that with a reasonable antenna tuning, you'd have no problem. So as you go to the higher and higher bands, you get a little bit of detuning from the close proximity of the lower bands, but it's a very minor effect. In fact, one of the things I want to do a little bit more research on, I found that there's some articles that start approaching it, but not quite as deep as I want to, in both the latest issue of the ARL antenna book and also the Radio Society of Great Britain, their main technical manual. And that is, if I built a fan dipole where the individual elements of the fan are not 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, but they're tuned to 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, 3.8, and 3.9 megahertz. That's a fan dipole within the 80-meter band. And either you do or don't connect the ends of them. Would that be an extremely low VSWR broadband antenna of 80 meters? I know the answer is yes. How good it would be is what I want to know. Would it act like I'm building a dipole out of a piece of copper tubing that acts like it's 5 feet in diameter, so to speak, or 10 feet in diameter? That would be a broadband dipole. And to physically do that on 80 meters, 133 feet long, forget it. I haven't got the resources to do that. But can I electronically get the equivalent of that by making an in-band fan dipole? That's an issue that I want to experiment with, both theoretically and in real tested hardware, because, let me drop.
DC2QIQ.
Glenn Recognize is going to pick you up in about a minute, Glenn. My greatest fame, it says here, where I've got those 30 or so patents with my name on the patent applications, of which 22 of them have been already issued, and six of them are antennas that are in manufacture. My claim to fame is to build at 900 megacycles very broadband antennas by way of very fat element made out of sheet metal. And that's a whole area that has never been properly investigated. The computer modeling programs cannot handle that. Therefore, I have found, as far as I'm concerned, a whole series of antennas that the world has never seen before because they can't be modeled and people haven't had the smarts to build them. So this cubical quad-like antenna with the five elements there, if he wants to eliminate some of those, I think the amount of retuning required is going to be extremely minor. That's my prediction until I read the article a little bit deeper. Glenn probably has, and he's going to give us a better answer. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. I did do the experiments with the narrow-banded dipole, and it was where, it's a fan dipole, where I started mounting, in the 20-meter band, I tried to make an extremely broadband 20 and a 10-meter, two separate antennas, where I took four elements, and I tried to break up the bands starting on the 10-meter band. And what I found out was that there was an interreaction where you could get good VSWR match, but the downside was that there started to be almost like a log periodic type of effect where with the elements one on top of each other started pointing straight up, and it didn't give me a very, very good pattern off the antenna. So then I tried mounting them almost like horizontally or, you know, side by side, and I did find out that it started pointing more into one direction than another. So there is some it's almost like steering, depending on how you arrange the wires. So I'm not sure it's really as beneficial as you'd want it to be. It's not going to be as omnidirectional anymore. But then again, maybe that might be something you're looking for. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very glad to hear that you went there, Glenn. But now there's another variable. You built some number of dipoles, fan dipoles, that are rather closely spaced frequency-wise and somewhat closely spaced physically. Were the ends of the dipoles all an open circuit? And if those ends were all connected by one cross piece of wire that picked up the tips of all of them on the right side and picked up the tips on the left side, it would be a skeleton equivalent of a double conical antenna. A very famous antenna that was used for television broadband reception was an antenna where the driven element, the dipole, so to speak, where it really was built as a wire triangle. And so the ends were all connected. So if you and I connect the ends, I think there's another huge benefit that can be gained. I wonder if you did that, Glenn. And if not, there's a further experiment you and I have got to do. KC2QIQ, KQRIW in the tech man.
Yeah, that's an experiment, Dick, I never did, but the good news is I have these two antennas still in my garage, and I can unroll them, put them back up again, and then attach the ends, and recheck the matches, and see what the performance looks like, see if there's any difference. I imagine there's going to be something different, but maybe in the spring, I'll let you know. But the spring isn't that far away. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, where I experimentally, using a vector network analyzer giving me a real-time display, building 900 megacycle antennas on this very small antenna range that I set up at my place of work, between my conference table and my desk, was the antenna range, 3 feet long, with a whole bunch of anechoic material scattered all around to stop the reflections. A funny-looking antenna range, but that so-called antenna range resulted in 30 individual patent applications, of which 20 some odd of them have already been granted. So what I'm getting at is that when you're doing it in real-time experimentation with tuning tools and watching the display, and that Rodenschwartz vector network analyzer would give me 30 displays per second, I never even saw any flicker on the screen. As I moved a tuning tool near one of the three elements of a Yagi, for instance, and I would electronically make that element shorter and longer, and I would see the way the gain curve and the standing wave ratio curve simultaneously being displayed. One was a blue curve, that was the gain curve. The yellow curve was the standing wave ratio curve. And I would move around the tuning tools to make the blue curve go up, that's gain, make the yellow curve go down, that's fizwa. And if I could do that simultaneously, I'd say, aha, that's the spot where I want to be. Ultimately, I found out that very wide elements would give me extremely good performance. And so if you and I take these individual dipoles and connect the ends, we are making the skeleton equivalent of these wide pieces of sheet metal that I was synthesizing, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. And why in the world should such a wide piece of sheet metal have such extremely broad bandwidth? In one particular case, there was an antenna we were building which under normal circumstances would have had approximately 10 or 12 megahertz of bandwidth, and it ends up having 150 megahertz of bandwidth. And my definition of bandwidth is where the VISWA throughout the whole band stayed below 1.1 standing wave ratio. 150 megs of bandwidth at 900 megs by making very wide sheets of copper foil. What I am guessing was happening is that the radio wave is looking for resonance, and when that radio wave on a wide sheet of metal can either go straight down the center, go along the edges, or because the sheet of metal is so wide, it can decide to zigzag itself across that wide sheet of metal, it finds a resonance. That's a theory. I'm not sure it's right. But I know that you can't model it with the currently available modeling programs, and yet that effect is there. So you and I can do the equivalent. You and I are not likely to take a sheet of metal on 20 meters, which is a triangle shape, which is a point right at the driven element, and it's going to be, let me pick a number, 10 feet wide at the tips. You and I are not likely to do that with a sheet of metal. but if I put a couple of wires in there and connect the ends, I can make it a skeleton equivalent that comes pretty close, and I think we can fool that radio wave into giving us a very wide visual bandwidth. And you and I, when it comes to ham radio, when it comes to ham radio, our specs are a hell of a lot easier. You and I are only looking for 2-to-1 or 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. In this commercial environment with radio frequency ID interrogators, I needed a standing wave ratio of better than 1.2, preferably 1.1, across the whole operating bandwidth. And a wide piece of sheet metal will do it, and I think you and I can come close. You see where I'm going on this one, Glenn? There's a whole area here that I think should be investigated. KC2QIQ, maybe you're the man to do it. K2RIW and the TechNet.
It definitely has merit, for sure. I can see that at higher frequency, especially if the antenna can be moved around, but my concern is always with the pattern of the, it's not as omnidirectional. But, I'll certainly be looking at it a little bit more again. Maybe I can revisit this spring and summer. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, John, look what your guy who wrote you a letter has kicked us into doing. He's put us to work this coming summer, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB, let me let it drop. Okay, Dick, he has one further question on this antenna, and I'm glad to hear Glenn. I haven't heard him in a couple of weeks. He's a busy guy. His question is, if you notice, when you look at that diagram, he has 5 leads connecting that antenna. He wants to know, is it possible for him to develop that with 1 coax cable feeding that whole group, rather than have 5 with a switch and all of that? Maybe you could help him out with that. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
As I see it, John, there's multiple answers here. The elegant solution would be 1 quality piece of cable going from the shack out to the antenna, and at the antenna he's got a single pole 5-throw relay, or a series of relays that give you a single pole 5-throw approach. That's the elegant approach. Now, can he simply combine all of those with T connectors into 1 particular cable? The answer is sort of yes. If he carefully chooses the length of the cable between those T connectors and the individual 5 antennas, I'm reasonably sure he can make that work by just a series of T connectors with the right length of cable. That's 1 approach. There's even a 3rd approach, and that is a multiplexer filter. Once you study filters, you realize there is a way to build a filter where you have 1 input coax connector and what looks like 5 individual bandpass filters connected to it, multiplexer. It's the next step after a duplexing filter. So you can have a filter where when what comes down the main cable is 80 meters, it'll go through the 80-meter bandpass filter into the 80-meter antenna, and all the other filters will not only reject the signal, but will act at the common point as an open circuit. You don't want the other filters to act like a short circuit at your operating frequency. When you really study what's going on with a filter, a bandpass filter, let me drop. We all think about the fact that in the so-called passband of a filter, it acts like a 50-ohm load, and the signal flows through with some amount of a delay, phase delay, because of the inductors and capacitors that are in the filter. Every filter has got a phase delay. And when you plot the phase delay versus frequency, it's called the group delay distortion phenomena. And for most of our circumstances, that doesn't matter. There are a few circumstances where the variation of phase going through the filter versus frequency gives you some grief. If, for instance, you're fielding, if that was part of the network that was feeding a multi-element phased array antenna, then that phase shift will give you some grief if you didn't compensate for it. So, but what I'm getting at is that everything you call a bandpass filter, on the frequencies it doesn't pass, in most cases the filter acts like a dead short circuit at that frequency. And that can give you some grief. Let me drop. However, if you're smart enough to realize that with coaxial cables, with certain kinds of transmission lines, you can easily get impedance inversion. if at the frequency where that filter we're talking about is rejecting that signal, it's a bad pass filter for, let's say, 80 meters, but at 40 meters, it acts like a dead short circuit. If on 40 meters there is a quarter wavelength of cable between that filter and your common point, your T connector going into this network of filters, if there's a quarter wavelength of cable, a short circuit at one end looks like an open circuit at the other end. That's called the frequency inversion characteristic of a quarter wave matching transformer. That's that simple quarter wavelength of cable is called a matching transformer. So if you're smart enough to set things up like that, and there's ways of doing it with inductors and capacitors, but also with lengths of cable. So without a doubt, if you're smart enough, you can definitely make a filter assembly that will only send each one of the correct frequency signals down the right filter into the right antenna. That's the Cadillac approach. I don't think you've got to go that far. From time to time, let me drop. From time to time at the flea markets, I will see a very high quality type N connector, single pole four throw electromechanical relay. Because it's single pole four throw and everybody's looking for a single pole two throw, nobody wants to buy it. And sometimes that $1,000 assembly made by the Transco company is being sold at a flea market for $11. And you buy one of those and the problem is ended, if you know what I mean. That's a very nice approach, single pole, four throw, or five throw relay. So there's lots of solutions to this one, John. And which is the best solution for you today with your pocketbook today versus the flea market you go to and your pocketbook tomorrow can continuously change. But it's a darn good question to ask because I know you don't have to run five cables out there if you don't want to. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the tech man.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I think that would be, one cable is nicer, especially he's taking it on a trip, and this design he made to fold it, magnificent, very nice. It's a nice machining, he's ready to build, but he just wanted to check. He had one other, would he be able to get the network information for those filters on the Berkeley site?
There's sort of a yes and a no to that. By the way, audio, your audio chart should be a little bit louder. You sound very good, very high fidelity, but you're 3 dB less volume than I am, because I'm listening to myself. What a narcissistic guy. Okay. The Berkeley site, and that means that you go to Google the word Berkeley plus filter synthesis, or filter plus Berkeley, and you'll find this beautiful website by Berkeley College, where it asks what is the frequency of your signal generator? Impedance of your signal generator? What's the impedance of your antenna or load? And what frequency you're operating at? And what's the minimum Q you want? You answer these questions and you press go. And in a fraction of a second, the Berkeley program gives you 16, count them, 16 solutions. And it tells you the exact way to set up the inductors and capacitors to be an L filter, a T filter, a pi filter, an LT, an L pi, and so on. You get a whole bunch of solutions. And you choose the one that you like. And in some cases it says an L network in this particular configuration, there is no solution. And so you think you've got 15 solutions, you've only got 14. But you get a beautiful answer one frequency at a time. Now, could a smart guy use the Berkeley program five times in a row, take the five separate solutions, and then combine them? Without a doubt. I didn't say it's easy. Better go a little bit slow, because bear in mind that each individual impedance matching network that Berkeley gives you, let me drop. Each individual Berkeley solution is a kind of an impedance matching band pass filter. So by other programs, you can fairly easily find out exactly what impedance when you get out of that filter on the off frequencies. In other words, if you built a filter for passing a 40 meter signal, and you want to know how the filter is going to behave if you feed it a signal on 80 meters or 20 meters, there is a program, which I don't know the name of right now, which will give you that answer. Once you've got that answer, and you apply it to each one of the Berkeley solutions, you'll find the combination where the other filters give you an open circuit on the non-used frequency. That's what you want. So when you set it up just right, all of the filters will be in open circuit except for one of them on this particular frequency you're operating on. So is that doable? Yes. I didn't say it's simple, but know in the back of your mind there's a beautiful solution there, and it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. The individual inductors and capacitors you put together for that impedance matching network for Berkeley don't have to be very expensive if you've got a reasonably good junk box. And when it comes to the inductors, you can wind your own out of 14-gauge or 20-gauge wire, so to speak. When it comes to the capacitors, there's a zillion ways that you can synthesize that capacitor out of tin foil and wax paper and the stuff you've got, if you know what I mean. But if you think that transmitting-grade capacitor is going to be expensive, if you're smart enough, there's ways you can build it yourself for not very much money. So there's lots of solutions here and lots of learning that can come out of it. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the second minute.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. So if he does choose to go with the filters, he wants them to be opened. All right. That's important for him to know that. Other than that, I think he's well on his way to doing a good job here. All right. That's about it from the mailbag. Let's go over to Paul. And back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay. WS2N, our space expert, Paul. Once again, I know it's a very redundant question on my part, but you got to tell me, what's the latest with Voyager? I am still enthralled by that thing. And I wonder if you believe like I do, Paul, when Voyager is out there right now at 8 billion miles, and how many antennas can possibly listen to that signal from Voyager, and you scatter those antennas out in space in various places, I say it's a million antennas. I say it's an infinite number of antennas. A billion-mile radius sphere around Voyager, how many antennas can I put into that? And the bigger sphere, because 8 billion miles is not the limit of Voyager. I know that we're going to be talking to Voyager at 12 billion miles someday. I say this infinite number of antennas I can put up. To anything that you or I transmit to Paul, I can place a million, I can place an infinite number of antennas out there in space to listen to that signal from you or me. There is no limit, in my opinion, in my philosophy. You see where I'm going on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, McTechnet.
Okay, Dick, this is WS2N. How many antennas? Well, they're only pointing in one direction. Will that matter, Dick? I mean, you're going to start picking up side lobes or something? I mean, very directional. Back to you, Dick.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Paul. Because Voyager is commandable, periodically NASA tells Voyager, aim that antenna at right angles to where it is right now. Aim all of your instrumentation in that direction. Tell me how much galactic wind you're getting now versus the solar wind, and then come back and report the result to us. So because Voyager is commandable to move the antenna in various directions, that gives me a lot of possibilities. At any one instant of time, I'm with you. At any one instant of time, the antennas listening to Voyager better be along that beam path. Otherwise, they're not going to get much signal. But even those side lobes and back lobes, as weak as they are going everywhere. You're going to need a hell of a lot more antenna to listen to that weaker signal to get it above threshold, but there's nothing stopping you from doing that. And the possibility exists in the early portion of the mission of Voyager. It had the ability to use its omnidirectional antenna. You only need the high-gain antenna when you're out there at long range and you want a particular data rate. So it probably has an omnidirectional antenna that they could switch over to, because most of the spacecraft do. Most of the manned spacecraft definitely did. When I was listening to, let me drop this. When I was listening to Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 on 2.8 gigs, 1971, I could hear astronaut audio when they were on the high gain antenna and it's aimed at Earth. When they're on the omnidirectional antenna, because they're doing some kind of a roll or yaw maneuver, and they were on the omni antenna, I didn't hear astronaut audio. I could very carefully tune and find the carrier. I could hear the tone in the noise, and I could hear the fact that they were there. I could hear the Doppler shift as they went around the moon and so on. But it wasn't above the signal strength that I could get audio out of it with my particular equipment. But the signal was there. So on the Omni from Voyager, I think I could put an infinite number of antennas out there, Paul. I didn't say how easy it's going to be to get that very weak signal, but I know it's doable. The signal itself never stops. Ain't that crazy? WS2N, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
I know. And that's proven from the Big Bang. You can still hear that background microwave signal 13.7 billion years later. So, there you go. By the way, too late to announce it now, but Cosmos, first episode is over. And I don't know if you recorded that or not, Dick, but I'm sure that's very well done. A lot of people have digital boxes like you, Dick. Some people don't realize you can hook up your old VCR to it or you know, a recording DVD device, and the pictures come out perfect. So when you play it back, I mean, some of them are, of course, they're not going to come out maybe with HD, but when the mine comes out, it's hard to tell if it's HD or not. It's perfect quality. I want to make about a half a dozen things here that I come across during the week, and yeah, it's about Voyager. I always look that up somewhere in the middle of the week, and last time I looked, it was 127 dB, for, dB, I'm not thinking about dB, 127 AU from us. That's Voyager 1. And Voyager 2 went over the 103 mark. It's 104 and a half of that. So it's a little bit more than that. Over 104 AU. And I think it's Voyager 1. No, Voyager 2. Voyager 2, where if you look at the distance from the Earth, it's going backwards. And that's because of where we are in our orbit around the sun. It's going away from us at a almost 40,000 miles an hour. But since the Earth moves around the sun at a little over around 66,000 miles per hour, then you've got roughly a 20,000 miles per hour difference at some point with both the either Voyager 1 or 2. It happens to be happening with the Voyager 2 right now. So that's always interesting to look at. And it's actually decreasing the distance between us right now. But not for long. That will change as the orbit of the Earth changes relative to the Voyager spacecraft. I wanted to mention asteroid DX-100 came in between the orbit of the Moon, probably one-tenth closer to us, you know, from the Moon at distance. Thing was about 80 feet in diameter. Could have done some damage if it hit the Earth, but it didn't. But these things are, you know, thousands and thousands are out there. They know of tens of thousands of these near-Earth objects, you know, coming by all the time. Once in a while, one or two get through, like this one. So it's always interesting. Yeah. Seems like we have a lot more nowadays. What's happening is they detect them. The equipment that looks at this stuff is much better. One other thing, anybody who lived during the early 70s remembers Skylab, one of the astronauts on board, William Pogue, just passed away, 84 years old. But he was on the last crew. There were three crews that went to Skylab. There were four launches. One was the launch of the Skylab itself. They actually used the Saturn V rocket to put that thing up there. And then the crew flights, there were the three crew flights that went up, and they were Apollo spacecraft type of capsules, three guys in each one. And they launched
on the S1B, the equivalent of the second stage. So if you looked at it, it was a shortened version. It looked like a shortened version of a Saturn V. You know, you looked at it real quick. But what it was missing was the first stage, the Saturn V itself. That's all they needed to put crews up there. And they would send it out on the same mobile launch platform, but they would have it, like, look like it was built on scaffolds, you know, I mean, rigid stuff, but that's where the, that's the way they did it. It was actually elevated above the mobile moving platform. So he was a good guy, apparently. William Polger, another guy that they, we lost. We're losing our astronauts, all the astronauts left and right. Guys worked on programs after retiring, they still do. And they all had goals of seeing people walk on the moon, things like that. But again, and a lot of them wanted to see people go to Mars. Some of them are making it. But there you go. Another guy from the 19, well, that the 19, there was the original 7, and there was a group of 19, which included Armstrong, those guys, Buzz Aldrin, even some of those guys gone, Neil Armstrong. So, this next week coming up, actually next Sunday, you have another launch on March 16th of the SpaceX cargo mission dropping. WS S2N SpaceX is sending another, I guess, 5,000 pounds of stuff, equipment, food, clothes, science equipment up to the space station, and it'll be their third contract launch. They've done it four times, and they have a $1.6 billion. Deal with NASA to do this, and they've got, I don't know, about 8 or 9 more of these flights left to go before that contract is up, and then they'll start in with manned flights soon after that, I'm sure. They'll get a contract with NASA for that. One thing, if you can watch this launch, it's going to be early in the morning, like 4 o'clock in the morning or something, I forget the exact time, so they launched from Florida on their new Falcon 9 rocket. You look at the bottom of the rocket, coming from the very base to about 60 feet up, no matter where you look, from what, you know, what position you see it from, you'll see these, they look like big struts coming down, and they're about 60 feet long. What these things do is they open up, hydraulically pressed out, after it's in flight, when it's coming down near the water. These are landing gears for the, for the first stage, we got it. Elon Musk, one of his goals was to have reusable spacecraft, reusable boosters, reusable second stage spacecraft. He wants it all reusable, so that's his goal. And he believes he could cut the cost of launching these not only Dragon spacecraft up to the International Space Station, but the Dragon on other missions to just even in orbit. He's got a lab planned on board the Dragon itself for experiments that could be done, which have nothing to do with the space station. And he's actually got them on the docket. But one of the things he wants to do is re-land all his equipment right back to Cape Canaveral. Now, it's not going to happen this time, of course, but this is the first time that he's put them on a spacecraft. And when it comes down near the water, he'll have the engine relight again, trying to duplicate landing on land. He has recovery ships out there, his own, and he'll pick them up and bring them back and take a look at them. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, he goes another half a dozen flights or so, you know, a year or two from now, and he'll probably make eventually the first attempt to bring back a liftoff booster back to
to a space to a space platform where it took off from, or maybe even a couple of miles away, but he had the ability to bring it down pinpoint accuracy. If you look at the YouTube, the Grasshopper, you bring up SpaceX Grasshopper, you can see the demonstration. He's had many flights go up, and he's gotten to the point, he's gotten this thing up to about 10,000 feet, I think, and he's able to bring it back down, or maybe a mile or something. I forget what the record is for him. But he's able to launch the thing, and then bring it back down and land exactly where it took off from. So it's pretty cool. A lot of companies involved with doing all this kind of thing. Blue Origin is one. They'd like to bring their equipment, their same equipment back to the launch facility. And a lot of private companies. Boeing's involved. They have something called the CST-100. They'd like to get this thing flying astronauts within probably a couple of years, maybe 2-3 years. The developments are coming along. They have ex-astronaut testing all the navigation equipment, and they're all building hardware. The CST-100 will have the capability of launching 7 astronauts to the International Space Station. So.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
One other thing is the space plane being built by Airbus, the European space plane. There's a lot of these suborbital things that are going to go to the edge of space and bring private passengers up. Virgin Galactic is one, you know, with their white knight that they're going to be putting up there and launching half a dozen people into suborbital space for $200,000. Well, this one here is called a space plane. It's built by Airbus. They plan on probably carrying 3 or 4 passengers. They think they're a couple of years away from doing it. Virgin Galactic, I think, is going to try it at the end of 2014. Along with another company called X-Corp. That's just going to be a pilot and you. You know, you're going to pay them your $90,000, and you're going to go for a ride with them. And they think they have a shot at doing this at the end of the year. So they're going to start off, they have a deal with some Chinese group. They're going to be doing it in Malaysia or somewhere or something. Some ridiculous far off land. So it's a company that comes out of California. So we're going to have a lot of future astronauts. You have to get up to 100 kilometers to qualify as an astronaut. You probably have over 500 people that have gone up to space. You know, it's days of Alan Shepard. And once these private companies are going, you're going to double that number in probably a couple of years. One other thing, if anybody watched 60 Minutes tonight, they had a story about the ALMA, antenna array in the Atacama Chile Desert. ALMA stands for the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, consisting of 66 antennas. They've been working on this thing for 30 years and it cost over $1 billion to build it. And it just came online last week. Starting to take pictures and get data. They have a supercomputer up there and all. And, so it looks like a real nice setup. 60 Minutes did a good job of covering the ALMA array. I don't know if you saw that. I know you're a big 60 Minutes fan. That was pretty cool. Back to that. This is WS. So if you have any questions, you could always go to my email, which is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N, SpaceNet, part of the TechNet.
I'm going to be turning it over to you guys in a minute for further questions for Paul. But I get the first crack at them, and that is, yes, I did see the 60 Minutes section about the El Tacoma plane. They didn't mention it, but that whole operation has been done by European Southern Observatory, ESO. If you Google the word ESO, European Southern Observatory, you'll see an awful lot of information about that operation. And I started communicating with one of their significant engineers, electronic engineers, starting in, December of 1999. That's when XQ2 FOD, Manfred Mortenwig, had this beautiful article in QST magazine about a 12-volt 40-ampere switching mode power supply. Let me drop it. A really beautiful piece of equipment. Under normal circumstances, you need an inverter or a switching type power supply that starts off with, say, 110 volts AC and gives you well-regulated 12 volts, call it 13.8 at 40 amps. There are very simple circuits that you can do that with. And you look at Manfred's schematic, the first half of the article was in the December issue, 1999. The second half, I think, was in January of 2000. And I started emailing Manfred, asking him questions about that power supply. And it was a lot more to the article than appeared in QST, where you asked him for further details and you downloaded his data. Beautiful design. And that design, I recognize the fact that a lot of smarts went into it. Why was it so elaborate? Had a lot of extra tuning capacitors and damping networks and whatever. And the reason why it had all those extra components is because that was the power supply he was using on the top of multiple mountains in Chile, where he lives, to maintain the computers, to maintain the repeaters that were there. He's the guy that had to maintain the repeater, so for him to climb the mountain and fix the darn power supply of his design forced him to making a very reliable design. That thing is short circuit proof, open circuit proof, over voltage proof, whatever. Self-protecting. Very well designed power supply. I started describing, started talking to him, and found out about his occupation at the European Southern Observatory in the La Salina area of Chile, where the majority of his operation was close to 10,000 feet. And periodically, he knew that this new array, Manfred knew that this new millimeter wave array was going to be set up a few miles further south on the El Tacoma plain, which is 16,500 feet. He went there a couple of times, got pretty sick with altitude sickness, and decided he wasn't going to live with that. He knew that they were going to force him, because he's their best electrical engineer that would fix all their equipment when it failed. And he knew that they were going to be sending him there every other day. And therefore, he quit the company. had a very desirable-sounding job, but because they were going to force him into doing that, he quit and went and built himself a house. But that's another whole story. And XU2 FOD, Manfred, you Google his word. He's got a beautiful website showing you the construction of his house and how he's got his own independent power supply running off a stream that's on the side of the mountain where he built his house. And he's quite a character. He's a very good homebrew enthusiast. He and I have got something in common. His very first serious ham radio construction was a kind of transmitter in a very compact box, and it looked identical to the thing that I built as my serious ham radio construction, which was a frequency-synthesized 6-meter rig in a bud box that was 4 by 5 by 6 inches, as I remember. And his box and my box looked very similar, even though he's a Spanish-speaking guy who knows English very well, of German background, living in Chile. Interesting character. What I was getting at, though, is that arguably one of the world's best radio astronomy installations on planet Earth is this one in La Salina, Chile. Both optical astronomy and radio. Let me drop it. The longest range, deepest measurement that was ever done with an optical telescope was done by that group. They looked at Halley's Comet.